Welcome to All Sides and the Reporter Roundtable. This is an hour where we catch up on the political news of last week and take a preview of the week ahead. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Joining us this week is Jesse Balmert, state government and politics reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. Welcome back, Jesse.
Thanks for having me.
And Laura Hancock is politics and policy reporter at Cleveland.com. Welcome, Laura.
Good morning.
And Noah Blundell is a reporter and editor for Hanna News Service. Thanks for joining us, Noah.
Good morning.
All right, so let's start with the higher education bill. At the top of the hour, I said, it's back. The Ohio Republicans promised to bring back this controversial bill after it did not pass last legislative session. And the bill's sponsor says that it would overhaul higher education and apply to the state's 14 public universities and 23 public community colleges. It is also intended to address what Republicans perceive as a, quote, liberal bias in higher education. They were met when they introduced the bill with a small group of students who showed up to protest. They were chanting, higher ed will be dead. So, Jesse, can you remind us what is in this bill? Now, and that's a big question because this bill has a lot.
Yeah, so there's a lot in this bill. It's now Senate Bill 1, but your readers might know it from Senate Bill 83. It was the last version. That bill ultimately didn't pass, in large part because the House Speaker at the time didn't bring it up for a vote. There's now new leadership in the Ohio House and Senate, and so this seems to be much more likely to pass this time around. So some of the things in this bill are a ban on diversity, equity, and inclusion, whether that be training, new scholarships being used in recruiting, would also ban faculty strikes. That was something that was negotiated out of Senate Bill 83, so that was part of the debate in the House. There'd be annual reviews and also post-tenure reviews. So even if you have tenure, you could potentially be fired for what is considered poor performance. There's some appeals process and so forth. There's also the universities can't take a position on controversial beliefs, which includes things like foreign policy, DEI programs, immigration, marriage, abortion. So there's quite a few things in here, and that's maybe only a few of them.
That's a few of them. And Laura, I'm sure you wrote about this bill the last time and you wrote about this bill this time around. What was added in that's different than last time that really stood out to you?
Well, the strike thing, as Jesse said, was in and out, and now it's back in. Mm-hmm. The universities have to adopt a statement saying that they support intellectual diversity, and I believe they have to post that online. And that is back. It was like different iterations in the last bill, depending on, you know, they just. Different versions of the bill. The bill started last year at like 33 pages. At one point, it went up to over like 100 pages. And then, you know, and this year, the bill's like 80 some pages this year, right? And so, so there's that. The China ban.
What is the China ban? Yeah.
They're prohibiting Confucius Institutes, although in the last like 5 years, there's been federal legislation that kind of was worded in such a way that pretty much every Confucius Institute at a university was closed. Confucius Institutes were these places where you could go to learn about Chinese culture and Mandarin language, and it was paid for by the Chinese government. People were concerned about the influence of China. So that's prohibited. And then also gifts, that kind of thing from China, you're not allowed to take, although they have no problem taking full tuition from students from China, even if they're on scholarship from their government. And there's concerns about how that's going to impact scholarship, because there's a lot of like legitimate scholarly collaboration on, you know, science and other, you know, areas that have that's funded. And, you know, it's hard to say, is that considered a gift from the Chinese government? And that's kind of a lot of the problems with the bill, is just that, you know, people don't know how far they can take it. You're required to have a 3-credit, like, American history course. And the course touches on a bunch of documents, such as the letter from the Birmingham jail by Martin Luther King Jr., Declaration of Independence, several of the Federalist Papers, just, you know, kind of those founding documents. If you've taken AP History or AP Political Science in high school, you've likely covered all this. Mm-hmm. And he did say that he was going to try to accommodate students who already have had this. He gets the ideas from, some of them were ideas that he thought up of.
This is the sponsor of the bill.
Yeah, his name is Jerry Serino. He's a Republican from Lake County outside of Cleveland. And some of these were his ideas. One thing he took from Florida, he's taken things from the Civics Alliance, which is a conservative social studies group. He's taken things from other various, like, conservative, like Manhattan Institute. So this was, like, a lot of model legislation incorporated. He believes that this is going to make Ohio colleges so much stronger. But then, you know, one reporter asked him, well, what about discussion of the Holocaust? And then he himself brought up discussion about flat earthers. And so basically you can stand up and say, as a student, I don't believe in the Holocaust. I don't think it happened. And then the teacher is going to have to take out time and explain the preponderance of the evidence that the Holocaust did happen. And so it's just kind of like, is that going to get in the way of high-level discussions, because a teacher is not going to be able to ignore or outright. So, of course, the university faculty unions are not for this, and students are not for this. It'll be just interesting, because I think there's a really good chance it's going to pass this year, because you have different leadership in the legislature. And I think it's going to pass fairly swiftly. And it'll just be interesting to see how this impacts, first of all, faculty wanting to come to Ohio and also students wanting to come here.
And Noah, the positioning of the bill, I mean, it's Senate Bill 1. One would assume that whenever a bill is first, it's the highest priority. Is that true?
Oftentimes, House Bill 1, Senate Bill 1 indicates top priority legislation. I think the confidence of Senator Serino and the leadership in this bill passing is shown by the fact that they've reverted to a prior version. And Senator Serino said in the fall that he would do this. He basically said he was done negotiating with former Speaker of the House, Jason Stevens, and that he would bring it back with some of the things he had negotiated away restored. Typically, when you have a sweeping bill like this that you've negotiated over the course of an entire session or multiple sessions, you lose things as concessions in order to get it done, and you don't reverse course when a new session starts, because you don't want to lose your progress. But I think he and leadership see the momentum that they can get some of the things that they had to negotiate away earlier. And I don't, if they were not as confident in the bill passing, I don't know that they would have reverted to those provisions.
Does it seem at all like they're willing to negotiate, or if they have hearings? I'm sure a lot of colleges and universities are going to have a lot to say about this.
Yeah, I think we'll see. I think the bill, as everyone has said, is going to be fast-tracked. So this is going to move really quickly. And so does that make it harder for people to kind of make sure they get there for either proponent or opponent testimony? This bill did have over 7 hours of discussion in its earlier version. Certainly there have been changes since then, and people will want to address those changes. But we'll see. I think what will be interesting, particularly when this bill gets to the House. Now, there is a companion bill that is being introduced in the House, so they're going to kind of look at it at the same time. But are some of the concerns that made it hard for this bill to pass committee last time going to still be there? Like the union provision, is that going to be a non-starter even for some Republicans? That's certainly something that we'll be watching for.
And the perspective of the governor is also important here. I mean, he's interested in a strong higher education system. This also affects, for example, the term lengths of the trustees that he gets to appoint. It makes them shorter.
The trustees to where?
The trustees of the of the institution. So the Ohio State University and all other university and community college trustees generally are appointed by the governor's office. And this would make their term lengths shorter.
So if they're appointed by the governor, but this bill is saying that they want the governor to be able to have more influence on that more often. Is that?
A governor would have greater opportunity to turn over the trustees of...
It would cut the term from 9 years to 6 years.
Right, so it would have more chance to turn over the trustees of people who may have been appointed before that governor took office, but it would also diminish the length of time that governor's influence would be there in terms of their trustees would then be up for appointment sooner, whereas if you appointed a trustee at the end of your term as governor... and they sit for 9 years, the next governor's 2 terms, that person may never come up for reappointment.
And Laura, we said at the beginning that this is because of a perceived liberal bias in higher education. I guess I'm trying to ask, where does that come from?
Just you're seeing it in conservatives all over the country, really. Mm-hmm. And yeah, a lot of, you know, university professors are kind of lefty, but we all know, including many members of the legislature who survived 4 years of university and still became strong Republicans. They, at the press conference, at least twice, maybe more, they use the word indoctrination.
Saying that higher education is indoctrinating students.
Right.
Okay.
And then there's also, like, we all have college professors when we think back on our college careers who, and I had an economics professor who was pretty conservative. I mean, we all had professors. It's not like they all are this way. And also, like, go into a petroleum engineering department at any university in the country. You're not going to get Marxist philosophy. Sorry. You know, so it's, so yeah, so there is kind of that perception and just trying to double and triple down, I think.
The review of tenure, too. I mean, that's something, once you get tenure, you pretty much are, you know, you have a job, right?
There are post-tenure reviews, but I don't think they're going to have all the requirements that what he wants.
And one other thing that the bill has is that it would require the Ohio Department of Higher Education to review whether some degrees could be completed more quickly. So sometimes 3 years instead of four. Is that something that... I mean, of all the provisions, I would think that maybe going a little faster could
be. And I wonder if that has to do with just like student debt loads. Mm-hmm. Getting out a year earlier saves quite a bit of money.
That's not a new idea. I think Governor Kasich had some kind of study or initiative to push for faster track 3-year degree programs in one of his budgets or other priority proposals.
So House Speaker Matt Huffman was formerly the Senate president. So as the Senate president, he allowed this bill to be taken up, have hearings, have a vote. So then presumably now that he's in the House, he will have it be taken up, right?
Yeah, I believe the speaker has said that this is a bill that he supports generally, that he wants to see pass, that he feels like there is need for higher education reform. So I don't think you're going to see him being kind of the wall against this proposal that the former speaker, Jason Stevens, was.
And the chair of the House Higher Education Committee also spoke at the press conference where Senator Serino reintroduced this bill, said positive things about it.
This is the Reporter Roundtable on All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we have Jesse Ballmert from the Columbus Dispatch, Laura Hancock from Cleveland.com, and Noah Blundo from Hannah News Service. So let's turn to the governor's race now and who's running for governor. Attorney General Dave Yost has called it the worst-kept secret in Capitol Square. He intends to run for governor in 2026. He made it official last week after dropping pretty big hints, including a black and white video showing him outside of the governor's office. And now he reshared that video in color, which I guess makes it official. So Yost originally planned to make his announcement in February. What prompted him to move up the rollout?
That would be the imminent campaign launch of Vivek Ramaswamy, former presidential contender, Ohio entrepreneur. Apparently he's also now going to formally launch in February, according to some new reporting from NBC News, I think. But recently, it seemed as if he was going to jump in this week.
Mm. So, yes, Vivek Ramaswamy is expected to announce his candidacy soon. He stepped away from his position with the Department of Government Efficiency. But it's been reported that maybe he might have been forced out. Right, Jesse?
Yeah, some of the reporting was kind of back and forth whether he and Elon Musk had the same vision for that new department. And I think as soon as two people were appointed for that role with strong personalities, some people kind of questioned how that would go. The AP also, Associated Press also reported that if you were a member of DOGE, you weren't going to be able to run for public office. And Vivek Ramaswamy had expressed interest in running for governor or even, you know, sought the U.S. Senate appointment. And so I think that was going to be a problem if you were done in mid-2026, that certainly is after the primary and certainly after a lot of these races were getting started.
Now, it's expected to be a pretty expensive race. Yost addressed that in a recent interview. Do we have a cut of Yost saying that? Yeah.
Am I going to have more money than Vivek? No. But honestly, you don't need the most money, you need enough money, and we're going to have enough and then some.
So, Laura, what do you think about money in this race? Is Vivek Ramaswamy going to have the most money?
He has the ability to self-fund. He is, I believe, is he a billionaire? I think he is.
Pretty close.
And, yeah, and he also has friends in Silicon Valley, including, I read one of the, you know, stories in the Washington Post. They were writing about why Vivek left, and they said that as part of him leaving, Elon Musk said that he was endorse him for Ohio governor. So that can come with a lot of money because, you know, Elon Musk gave Senator, well, now Vice President Vance, I believe the highest individual highest contributions because he basically supported a PAC for him. And so, I mean, that's going to be a lot of money. And so, yeah, I mean, it's going to be pretty expensive. I mean, this is all being kind of hastened up because at first it was about John Husted, lieutenant governor. He was running for governor. And so I think everybody else was like slowly going to ease in. Like, Yost was supposed to enter the race next month, and now he's in this month because there's that opening now that Husted is our senator.
So what do you think of the Dave Yost campaign? I mean, it sounds like Dave Yost has wanted to have been governor for a long time. Maybe as much as it seemed like John Husted wanted to be governor, right?
Right. Number one, it's insane that we're talking about 2026 so early, but this is the political cycle that we're in. And so, yeah, Dave Yost has been interested in running for governor. He has a history of statewide public office. He is currently Ohio Attorney General. He previously was the Ohio Auditor. He started in Delaware County as like the prosecutor and auditor there. And so his pitch is really going to be, I'm the person you know. I'm the person who knows Ohio. I've been to these dinners with Republicans across the state. Like, I'm the person with the experience for this job versus Ramaswamy, who is an Ohio native, you know, but has not like cut his political teeth here, has not run for political office in Ohio before.
And Noah, who else are we expecting to jump into the race on the Republican side for governor?
So State Treasurer Robert Sprague, formerly a state legislator from the Findlay area, I think, I think it's Findlay, has indicated that he will run. I think he has filed the paperwork to change his designation of treasurer to say that he's running for governor. I think another interesting dynamic here is going to be potential running mate decisions. Unlike in the presidential, you pick your lieutenant governor running mate before you appear on the primary ballot. So it's not like you can win and then decide who your number two is going to be. So last time we had a large competitive gubernatorial primary field, the leading candidate picked one of the other candidates. Mike DeWine picked John Husted, thinned the field, combined their fundraising, combined their appeal, and, you know, kind of rolled to victory from there.
And a part of that deal was that he would be next in line for the governor, but then everything else changed.
Yes.
I think at the time he didn't know a U.S. Senate seat would be available.
Probably not. Yes. I mean, who can predict all of this? Who would have thought that, you know, Ohio's own J.D. Vance would be the vice president now, right? Would you have predicted that 4 years ago, 8 years ago?
No, I don't think we even knew he was interested in U.S. Senate at that time.
No,
so.
Probably not. Yes. He was just an author back then, right? This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and this is the Reporter Roundtable. And coming up, we're going to talk about the Ohioans who received pardons from President Trump for their involvement in the January 6th riots. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
We could all use a little help navigating the news these days. The Consider This podcast wants to give you a hand. 6 days a week, we'll help you make sense of the day's biggest news story and what it means for you in less than 15 minutes. Listen now to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides, and this is the Weekly Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we talk about all things Ohio politics. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Still with us, Laura Hancock, politics and policy reporter at Cleveland.com. Thanks again for being here, Laura.
Thank you.
And Jesse Ballmert, state government and politics reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. Thanks again for being here, Jesse.
Always good to start the Monday off.
And Noah Blundo, reporter and editor at Hannah News Service.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here, Noah. So 85 Ohioans were charged in the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol and were granted clemency last week. Of that total, 70 from Ohio did plead guilty or were found guilty at a trial. They were among the 1,500 that President Trump cleared of any wrongdoing. And Laura, before Trump took this action, there were some, including Vice President J.D. Vance, who said that he did not believe clemency was appropriate for those convicted of the most violent crimes, like assaulting a police officer. There were 14 Ohioans accused and convicted of assaulting police officers. So what do you make of these pardons? It was sweeping, and Ohio was a part of the sweep.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you saw over the year at first, he kind of made a very, you know, when he first left office, he acted like these people needed to be prosecuted. And then it suddenly became an act of love. And people were just visiting the Capitol like normal tourists. So, you know, this was coming. There was one individual who got clemency, but not a pardon. Jessica Watkins. And she owned, and maybe still owns, a bar in Urbana in Champaign County. And she started a small militia. And she was in contact with Stuart Rhodes, who is from the Oath Keepers. He runs the Oath Keepers. And so she had 8 years in prison. And Trump didn't, like, write off her conviction, but he is allowing her to leave prison early.
So she's still have been found guilty. She just doesn't have to finish the term. Is that what that means?
Yeah, yeah. Because most of these people in Ohio are the 70 of the 85 are, that's going to be wiped off their record as if
it never happened.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. And here is J.D. Vance yesterday on CBS's Face the Nation talking about this.
What the president said consistently on the campaign is that he was going to look at a case-by-case basis.
This is blank.
And that's exactly what we did. We looked at 1,600 cases. And the thing that came out of it, Margaret, is that there was a massive denial of due process of liberty. And a lot of people were denied their constitutional rights. The president believes that. I believe that. And I think he made the right decision.
So Vance has said that he didn't think that all of these people should receive pardons or clemency, but in that clip, he sounds like he's walking it back slightly, right? What do you?
Yeah, 14 of the 85 in Ohio, their case was in the process of being, you know, it was in court, and there wasn't a conviction or anything yet, and Trump asked prosecutors to dismiss those. So yeah, it's interesting that you also have to wonder if these people were, like, you know, a different color skin, if they would have been given as much kind of sympathy. Mm-hmm. It was the people who went after the cops did get less legal remedies than the people who just kind of went in and broke into the Capitol.
And Jesse, before the break, we were talking about how no one would have predicted 8 years ago that J.D. Vance would be in the position that he's in, right? So in that same interview on Sunday, J.D. Vance talked about being the tie-breaking vote to confirm Pete Hegseth as the new Secretary of Defense. Can you imagine, you know, even 2 years ago saying that J.D. Vance would be the tie-breaking vote for something like that?
Yeah, I mean, I think politics has changed a lot recently, and you certainly see these people who, you know, position themselves well and get out in front of their constituents well, and certainly have the support of Donald Trump doing quite well in politics. And so J.D. Vance, who previously had some misgivings about Trump, was the person who was endorsed by him in the Senate race, and that certainly helped him win. And then obviously got the nod of approval for the vice presidency. So I think those connections have, you know, served Vance well in his political aspirations.
Yeah, and Noah, you mentioned earlier that, you know, the Trump endorsement. So if Vivek Ramaswamy can run for governor and hold on to Trump's favor, I mean, that does carry a lot of weight in a state like this.
Particularly if the primary is crowded. If you've seen some of the recent congressional openings where there's, you know, 5, 10, 15 people running, you know, the power of Trump to endorse and give someone several points or 10 points in the polls, when that crowded of a field kind of becomes dispositive, it just settles it. It's, you know, in a head-to-head contest, maybe not as much power, but still obviously very influential.
And backtracking a little bit, when we were talking about who's going to run for governor on the Republican side, we neglected to mention that we still do not have a lieutenant governor at this exact moment. One would think that the lieutenant governor would be a candidate to run for governor. Do you think that that is something that's on Governor DeWine's mind, Jesse?
So it's possible. The question is going to be really, does he want someone who's going to be kind of a placeholder? Obviously, you can have a lot of impact over a 2-year period of time, but someone who might be more aligned with DeWine's strategy for Ohio versus you want to create a new candidate in that governor's race, which is already potentially quite crowded. And so that's one of the decisions he's going to have to make. I believe this position also needs to be approved by the House and the Senate. So you would also need to get through a few other processes.
The lieutenant governor has to be voted on by the House and Senate?
The Senate. For a vacancy.
For a vacancy.
For replacing a vacancy.
So at some point this week-ish, we don't know when, Governor DeWine will put a name forward of someone who he wants to be his lieutenant governor, and then it has to be voted on.
He was asked at the press conference where he announced John Husted would be our new senator, and he said, one big decision is enough for today. I'm going to take the weekend, celebrate the inaugural and the swearing in of Husted and then come back. So, there's been, I guess, speculation around the development director, Lydia Mihalik, former mayor of Findlay. I believe when Bob Taft needed a new lieutenant governor at the end of his second term, he picked his development director, Bruce Johnson. The development director is a person who is out there selling Ohio. Jobs, jobs, jobs is kind of the de facto mantra of most governors since Jim Rhodes, and the development director is very focused on that and on promoting Ohio. The tourism department is in development. So if you want somebody who's sort of, brand positive about the administration and the state, your development director is a good candidate for that.
Governor DeWine is, extremely popular. I believe he won, 80% when he was up for re-election. Democrats even like him. So if he picked somebody that he was looking at for a long-term governor, he could very much tip the scales. And I don't know if he really wants to get involved in that or if he wants the Republicans to sort of decide in their own primary. Mm. It'll be interesting to see.
I was out of town this weekend, and we crossed the border and drove back into Ohio, and it said Ohio, heart of it all, and it said Governor DeWine and Lieutenant Governor John Husted right on the sign, and I looked up and I said, well, that needs to change.
They might be waiting to update the signs till they have a new name.
I saw Lieutenant Governor Husted's picture in a rest stop over the weekend as well, or last weekend, I think, and thought, oh, yep, that's going to...
All this signage has to change. Yes, it's interesting to think. I don't know if they have to make a whole new sign or if they just put a new name up there. We'll see what happens. This is the Reporter Roundtable on All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We have with us Noah Blundo from the Hanna News Service, Jesse Ballmer from the Columbus Dispatch, and Laura Hancock from Cleveland.com. So, we talked about the higher ed bill being Senate Bill 1 in the last segment, but there's lots of other bills being unveiled. Noah, can you give us an idea of a bill that you're watching besides the higher education bill?
Yeah, so there is, I think not necessarily a particular bill at this moment. Well, there's a related bill, but property tax changes reform is going to be, I think, high priority for legislators. A lot of constituents complaining about it. That may end up just being something that comes into the budget bill, which will be introduced in a couple weeks.
So it's called the Property Protection Act right now. Does that mean it's not a bill yet, or it's just a discussion?
That's a different bill. I think that one is about restricting certain people who can buy property in Ohio. I'm just talking about your school taxes and your county,
okay, well,
county
then forget what I said. You talk about
sorry,
your
but
thing.
There is, so intersecting with that, there is a bill in the Senate Bill 3, that would phase down Ohio's income tax to a single flat rate. Republicans have talked about eliminating or flattening the income tax for years, decades now. We had, 9 brackets a while ago. We're down to 2 Some people want to make the final push to one, as in Senate Bill 3, but also there's going to be this pressure for property tax relief, which also costs money. So, you know, taking revenue out by reducing this income tax is going to be in tension with that, because there are constitutional requirements for how the property tax is administered. So you can't fiddle around too much with property tax itself, but there's been talk of creating a circuit breaker program where, like, if your property taxes become so much of your income or go up by so much, the state would compensate you via an income tax credit, which would not directly affect the administration of property taxes, but would give you relief via, but that has to be paid for.
That sounds very complicated.
Yes, it's all very complicated.
So you're saying that right now they're trying to put something, some sort of change to income tax or property tax in the budget bill. But if that doesn't work, they'll make it a separate bill?
No, it will almost assuredly be resolved in the budget, because that's sort of the budget bill is the bill where there's a constitutional requirement for us to have a balanced budget every 2 years. And the budget bill is where they make the black ink and the red ink line up. So you don't have separate legislation to make enormous spending and taxation decisions, because that messes with the red ink and black ink math of the budget bill. So there is this bill to phase down the income tax, which was introduced previously. There will probably be discussions of property tax relief. It's all going to get rolled into the budget. So we probably haven't seen all the ideas that are going to be discussed yet. But one big one that got introduced recently was the idea of getting rid of, I think we have a 3.5% and a 2.75% income tax bracket. And this would just collapse those two into a single 2.75%.
What makes this the year that'll happen if it's been introduced 10 times?
Well, that's the last step to go out, besides outright eliminating the income tax. They've been, like I said, going down from 9 brackets to 7, you know, to 4, now to 2. So one bracket's the only place to go if that's going to be your strategy.
And has now House Speaker, former Senate President Matt Huffman, indicated his feelings on this idea?
I know the Speaker Huffman has said that he doesn't think eliminating the income tax entirely is feasible, in part because Ohio doesn't have, like, Disney World. It doesn't have a large, like, stash of oil underneath. What we have is people who own properties and work. And so it's hard to completely eliminate a tax base. But that has been, as Noah said, the strategy of Ohio's lawmakers for quite some time, is to reduce the income tax or reduce the number of people who are paying it at the rate that they're paying it. So I wouldn't be surprised if that is, you know, continuing to move in that direction. But I think they're going to stop short of eliminating it entirely, at least in this 2-year budget.
And Laura, another bill that is expected to move forward is House Bill 2, the Child Care Credit Program. Do you know about that?
Haven't really looked into it, but I remember last legislative session, there were a slew of bills that created kind of, like, one of them did a TRICARE type situation, kind of like what they have in Michigan and some other states, where you have the state paying a chunk, the employer paying a chunk, and then the family paying a chunk. And, you know, there's a real problem where, you know, employers can't find, or they're, you know, to an extent they're struggling finding quality workers because people can't find places to put their kids while they go to work. And so this is a priority of not only early childhood learning groups, but it's also a priority of the Ohio Chamber of Commerce to make sure to do something about childcare. During the pandemic, a lot of places shut down because of all the restrictions of how many kids you could have in a building, and they didn't open back up, and you just don't have enough spots for all the children.
Does it have anything in it to get child care workers paid more? Do you know?
I don't know. Yeah. I that don't might help. Know if the Republicans would be down with that, quite honestly.
Yeah. There's another student-related bill, a School Bus Safety Act. Do you know about that one?
I know that there's been an issue over the last several years where there's a group in the legislature that would like to have children in seatbelts. We've had some pretty high profile accidents involving children on school buses. Governor DeWine convened a working group that ultimately came to the conclusion that seatbelts are not the way to go, especially with little kids, because say if there's a fire on the bus, they might not be able to figure out how to unclick their belt and evacuate safely, and it's going to be left on the driver to do all that. You know, it just could be a problem. And so the working group decided ultimately not to go the seatbelt route, although there are individual districts that have gone ahead and just said, well, from here on out, when we get a new bus, we're going to get belts in it. You also have like different seatbelt, like if you have larger children, like high schoolers versus little kids, you know, there's kind of the question about, are you over restraining little kids? And then if you hit the brakes, would that be a problem? That kind of thing. But so that it would cost millions of dollars. And so I know that the price tag has always kind of been a reason why the bill hasn't moved forward.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Part of this will be whether the state puts up money to help. You know, the state has put up money generally to help before to help school districts replace their aging buses. And so it's possible they would create some kind of program to help them replace their buses or retrofit them with some of these. There's also the discussion of the cameras on the buses part of the problem is not what's happening inside the bus, but all of the people outside the bus and whether they're stopping the appropriate distance behind, whether they're, you know, yielding and stopping when the little red stop sign arm comes out, or whether they're driving around like maniacs, as we all see on the road every time.
This is All Sides in our reporter roundtable, and we're going to talk about more things in the works at the State House when we continue after this break on 89.7 NPR News.
We could all use a little help navigating the news these days. The Consider This podcast wants to give you a hand. 6 days a week, we'll help you make sense of the day's biggest news story and what it means for you in less than 15 minutes. Listen now to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides in the Weekly Reporter Roundtable. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Still with us, Laura Hancock, politics and policy reporter at Cleveland.com, Noah Blundo, reporter and editor for Hannah News Service, and Jesse Ballmer, state government and politics reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. So, Jesse, you retweeted Governor DeWine, his statement declaring the Celebration of Champions Day because a certain football team won a big prize and they had a big celebration. And were you there? You want to tell us about it?
Yes, I was. I will note that I am Ohio University grad, so like Bobcats first and foremost. But growing up in Columbus, it was just really fun to get to see this team in particular that's overcome so much adversity and just at times hate in order to really like reach their ultimate goal. So they had a big celebration yesterday at the Horseshoe, and Governor DeWine was there, and Columbus Mayor Andy Ginther and Coach Ryan Day got to speak. And so it was just kind of fun to celebrate this team and relive some of the better moments from that championship run.
And the governor declared it the Celebration of Champions Day, so a special day here in Ohio. What was the atmosphere like? 30,000 fans, some of them lined up really early to make sure they got good seats.
Yeah, I will say January is a rough time for championships, so it was cold, but I think people were excited about it. It's worth noting the dance team also won a national championship, and so we're celebrating a few different national championships that day for Ohio State. Yeah, I think it was Jack Sawyer, one of their star players from the Pickerington area, like trolled us all by saying he was going to come back for a fifth year, but that was not actually an option for him. So, but hopefully lots of other players will come back and we'll have a great season next year as well.
And so it was very cold, but I guess it would have lost a little something if they would have moved it to the Schottenstein Center or something. It needed to be in the Shoe, right?
Yeah, I think for the seniors and for just like the players, that this is a place where they, you know, had played a lot of hard games and, you know, won some and lost a notable one. And so I think to have,
oh, I hadn't heard about
to
that.
Have yeah. good memories of the horseshoe to go out on, I think was great. And it's nice they got a key to the city, and I think we're going to rename a road or something. So you get stuff like that when you win big championships.
Yes. Anyone else want to talk about it? I don't know. I don't want to interrupt you from talking about the national championship game. We can get back to politics, though.
It wasn't just the football team. I believe his proclamation also recognized the dance and spirit team victories that happened right before or right after the game.
Lots of champions. Yes. We're full of champions. All right. So another thing that we wanted to talk about is, Laura, you wrote about a new requirement for substitute teachers. Can you talk about what is happening there to help fill that gap?
Okay, so there has been, since the pandemic, districts have said that they've really struggled finding people to substitute teach. So the legislature passed since 2020 four bills to make it more flexible. Some of them are offering temporary flexibilities, and then they made them permanent. So nowadays, a substitute teacher does not have to have a bachelor's degree, and that's permanent. That has resulted in, there's about 30,000 people who hold substitute teaching licenses in the state. Or they have to undergo background checks that are done by the Ohio State Board of Education is who does the background checks. But there's been a lot of shifting of, even though the number has not increased, there's a lot of shifting in who's, you know, wanting to substitute teach. So the State Board of Education is really struggling, trying to keep up with all these requests, because they're just getting so many more requests for background checks. And then also, if you hear that somebody got picked up for DUI two counties over, you also go call the state board and ask them to do a little search on that. You know, so they have less staff and they're really getting overwhelmed. Now, Ohio, for permanent teachers, non-substitute teachers, Ohio actually is one of 13 states that falls below the national average, which is around 6.something% in the number of teachers who are teaching like sort of off license. So they might be teaching outside the grade bands that they're licensed for. They might be teaching like in a subject area that they're not licensed for. There's only about 1 in 20 teachers in Ohio is teaching outside of their license. There's like in Washington, D.C., almost a third of the teachers are teaching off their license. So, you know, Ohio is doing well with that. They are, permanent teachers are, you know, teaching what they're qualified for.
So in the substitute teacher issues, I mean, they stem back to the pandemic. We were having a hard time finding enough substitute teachers. There's still a shortage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I know that, for instance, you know, like a teacher or like a part of a class would get sick. So there were just a lot of teachers who were out, especially during the pandemic. I'd heard that that was really hard. And then you were trying to find people to fill in.
And before we run out of time here, I wanted to make sure we got a chance to talk about the budget process. So, Noah, you mentioned it before. The budget has to be presented by a certain date. Obviously, it's not due until June.
Yeah, so 4 weeks after the legislature organizes for the biennial session, the two-year session, which was January 6th this year, the governor has to present his executive budget. That's the baseline. That's the beginning of the process. It's debated in the House. They'll pass it sometime in probably April. Then it will go, or early May, it will go to the Senate. And then it must be signed by June 30th, which is the end of the fiscal year. The new fiscal year begins July 1st. So we have a constitutional requirement for the budget to be balanced.
And Jesse, is there anything in particular in the budget that you're looking for? Something that, you know, that is something that's on your mind whenever you see what they come up with?
Yeah, it's such a massive document. So some of the tax stuff that we talked about earlier, where the income tax is going to be set at, but we're also going to have a conversation about school funding for K through 12. And there was this Cup Patterson deal kind of that was made about 6 years ago. It was supposed to be implemented over like 3 2-year chunks, and this would be that last like 2-year chunk of it. And the Speaker Huffman has said that that was unsustainable and that this is a fantasy, that this would be funded for the next 2 years at the same rate that was initially proposed. And so that'll be a big fight in the budget and, you know, something to keep an eye on.
That is also, sorry, that's also about what he said for the first and second phases of Cutt-Patterson, and they happened. So, you know, his word isn't the final word, but he certainly has a lot of influence in how that decision plays out. And also whether what other education priorities get funded. You know, he's been involved in a lot of the school choice expansions that happened alongside Cutt-Patterson as far as ed choice being available to basically every family in Ohio now.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I was going to talk about, is just the vouchers. How much more can you expand vouchers? Right now, if you're like a millionaire, you don't get the full voucher. You only get about 10%. So that's an area where they could expand. You could layer vouchers on top of each other. There was a bill last session where they wanted to give an Ed Choice voucher, which is around, you know, $6,100 for elementary and $8,500 for high school, on top of a John Peterson or an autism voucher. And the John Peterson scholarship can go up to $30,000 a year, depending on what your, it's a special needs scholarship. So they, so there's that. They could layer vouchers on top of each other. They could create education savings accounts, which is like, it would be tax-free money, kind of like what you do for college with your kids. Tax-free money for private schools. There's lots of things they can do to do more for private school vouchers.
Is the goal for private school to be free?
Is that, no.
I mean, are we getting toward that?
The goal is for some lawmakers, not all, but some lawmakers want the money to follow the child. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to go to public school or private school, and then I think some of them, more cynically, I would say some of them, the goal is to kind of depopulate public schools that they see as failing.
All right, we're down to just a couple minutes left. Jesse, what else are you looking for previewing this week that's coming up, or what are you planning on writing about?
So I believe we will have our first hearings on that higher education bill that we started the top of the hour with. And so I think it'll be really interesting what questions lawmakers have, particularly the Republican lawmakers who hold the majority, that would indicate whether this is going to do anything other than just, you know, fly on through.
Mm-hmm. And Noah, what are you going to be writing about this week?
Well, I think state government and the legislature will determine that. we talked a lot about campaigns for 2026. As we were having this conversation this hour, the state auditor, Keith Faber, announced his candidacy for attorney general, which was long expected. But we have Secretary of State race. We have a treasurer race, in addition to the races for governor, attorney general, lieutenant governor, et cetera. So it's apparently campaign season already.
And Laura, what are you planning on writing about this week?
The Nation's report card comes out on Wednesday. So I will be looking at that.
Tell her what is that?
Okay. So, NAEP National. Anyway, it looks at fourth grade and eighth grade math and reading, mm-hmm. or English language arts. And it's just, it's a good way for Ohio, because a lot of the tests that Ohio students take, you're just comparing them to different schools and different, like, how they did last year versus this year. You're looking at how they grew and the amount that they learned, that kind of thing. This is actually one where you can say, like, oh, Ohio's better than Iowa or whatever. You can look at it and do comparison. So that's coming out on Wednesday. And then there's going to be a report from Groundwork Ohio. They're a big child, early child education advocacy group, and they're doing a big report, I believe, Tuesday, Wednesday. I can't remember. All the days are blending together. But so those are the two things that I'm kind of looking at.
It's only Monday. We'll start there. But we'll probably be writing about who the new lieutenant governor is at some point this week, too, right?
At some point. Who knows if it's this week?
I don't know why Governor DeWine wants to drag it out, because he gets a lot of calls, I think, from people wanting the job.
All right. And so we are out of time, but I want to say thank you to our guests today. So thank you to Laura Hancock, politics and policy reporter at Cleveland.com. Thank you, Laura.
It's been fun.
And also reporter and editor for Hannah News Service, Noah Blundo. Thanks for being here.
Thanks.
And state government and politics reporter at the Columbus Dispatch, Jesse Ballmer. Thank you, Jesse.
Yeah, happy start of the week.
And this is the Reporter Roundtable. This has been All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.